Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Today's program was brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host. Funny how that works. Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about taste. Actually, not just taste really, but taste in the broadest sense. Food and art and culture and all the sorts of aesthetic and delicious things that make our world a wonderful place to be. And today we're going to have a particularly interesting conversation because we're going to be talking about, let's say, the taste of books. My guest today is Cara Canella, who is, among other things, curating a book club, called Brooklyn Kitchen Book Club at the incredible Brooklyn Kitchen, not too far from us here at Roberta's. It's in Williamsburg. We're in Bushwick, but those lines, I think, are sometimes made up by real estate salespeople or whatever. And so just up the road, welcome to Roberta's.
Hi, Cara. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
If for no other reason than your last name means cinnamon in Italian, and you would have to end up doing something related to food.
Exactly.
Yes. My favorite spice. Tell me, books, huh? Like, as someone who has been interested in food, who has a PhD in food, and has written a couple of cookbooks, I can't believe the number of interesting, not cookbook food books that come across my desk today. So, what's going on?
Right. Well, one interesting trend is this hybrid of cookbooks mixing with narrative now. I think that's relatively new. And, you know, Tamara Adler does that in her book, An Everlasting Meal, which was our first book for the Brooklyn Kitchen Book Club, which launched last week on June 20th. So she writes in this really beautiful, fluid narrative style and kind of effortlessly weaves in recipes as well. So you're learning how to cook almost without even, you know, realizing it.
Right. And I guess food, I mean, today is actually a sad day in the world of food and fiction with the loss of Nora Ephron, who was a great food lover and always wove food into her projects and then even did a few that were about food. I mean, Julie and Julia and that sort of thing. What is it about food that it adds to the texture of a book, do you think? I mean, we're talking fiction now.
Right. Well, I think the sensory experience, you know, a lot of people read to have vicarious experiences. And if you're going to have one, why not make it delicious? And, you know, when you're cooking, it's the textures and sounds and smells in the kitchen. It's just very alive. And that's what makes the best writing, too, including all of those senses.
Hmm. And the best radio, too. One of the things we're always trying to do is to evoke the taste of something or the look of something mm-hmm. over the air when you can't really see it. So I'm reading a book. I come. Do you think people are using food just because it's trendy, or do you think there's something deeper than that going on when authors are taken by the motif of a meal or cooking or a recipe? Because sometimes to me it feels like recipes are just stuck in the ends of chapters because they're cool now and people are looking for that. And then sometimes you come across something that's a beautiful piece of writing where the food really evokes an extra sensory experience. What do you think?
Right. Well, I do agree, you know, that this whole foodie thing has become a trend.
And here we are in the middle of a trend in a trendy restaurant and a trendy radio show and a trendy radio network.
Right. But, you know, I think in this age where we're all attached to these digital devices, iPads, you know, iPhones, and so much of our life is lived in our heads, I think people, you know, including writers, are craving grounding. And you can access that by cooking. And so, you know, cooking brings us back to the earth and you know, puts us in the present moment. And so much of what we do these days, you know, is abstract and does not. So I think, like, a lot of people right now are drawn to making things with their hands and, you know, this mm-hmm. artisan movement. I think the more and more interest in cooking is also tied to that.
Hmm. I'll remind our listeners that if you have questions about books, or maybe you want to start your own book club, or cook something, or I don't know, maybe you just want to know where to eat, give us a call. You can give us a call if you're listening live at 718-497-2128, or you can write us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.org. There's recently been a shift, and we're now a wonderful nonprofit radio station whose mission is to elevate the cultural aspect of food. So info@heritageradionetwork.org. You can also tweet us at Taste Matters HRN. And if you're listening to the podcast on iTunes, that's a especially good way to get in touch with us and ask us a question that hopefully we'll get to in the next show, or maybe we'll just answer you anyway on Twitter. Are people reading books anymore? That's
yeah.
That.
Well, apparently, yeah. I think, more of a challenge, you know, these days with so many distractions. But look at Oprah's book club, just, you know, relaunched, revamped with Cheryl Strayed's Wild. I think that, again, at least I personally am trying to, you know, block out time where I'm just reading and my phone is far away from me. And so I feel more of a craving to concentrate on.
And do you read books on paper, or do you read them on these things like I have in my hand, this tablet device?
All paper. But now that I started editing a website about books. So I'm having, you know, physical galleys and copies sent to my apartment, and that's getting old. So I might be moving to an iPad soon.
What is the website and what are you talking about there?
It's called Biography. File, and it's published by Random House, and it's covering a biography, a memoir across all publishers, which is pretty significant. That, you know, a Random House site is
right.
Our book featured on the homepage this week is a memoir by a guy named Dan Smith called Monkey Mind, a memoir of an anxiety, and that's published by Simon and Schuster. So we have featured some great food books on that site, like Gabrielle Hamilton's Blood, Bones, and Butter.
Sure.
Let's see, one that I hope to cover soon because I loved it, is Heat by Bill Buford. Mm-hmm. There's an upcoming Julia Child biography coming out in August.
So let's think a little bit. I was actually, at the top of the show, I was thinking more about the nonfiction books, the books about salt, the books about spices, the books about the most mundane or the largest topic, nonfiction mostly, although I think the best of them really master narrative in a way that really gets you inside the story, and what, there's been an explosion there too. I mean, who's reading those books? Do you have any idea? Are you going to address those with your book club?
Yeah, definitely. Mark Kurlansky is on our radar. You know,
so he's the author of Salt and of Cod and of a bunch of really great, incredibly researched books.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like that delving, you know, in depth into one ingredient and telling a story of, you know, culture and time through that ingredient. And Michael Pollan does that kind of in The Botany of Desire, but with four crops, you know, marijuana, tulip, apple, potato. And ever since I read
what else do you need?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Ever since I read that book, I just look at those four things in the world so differently in such like a well-rounded, in-depth way. And, you know, if I had all the time in the world, I'd love to look at everything that way. So,
good. Are you working on a book? Do you have aspirations to write a book, one wonders?
I do. In fact, I started my book club, the one that preceded the Brooklyn Kitchen Book Club, after I graduated from grad school, which was an MFA in creative writing and nonfiction, where I worked on essays. And yeah, eventually I'd like to continue those and publish them. But so I started the book club because I missed, you know, discussing books in a really like focused, passionate way with people. So I finished grad school in 2006 and started the book club in 2007 after meeting someone at a slow food event who, you know, I ran it by her. If I started a book club reading about food, would you join? She said, yeah. So we started from there and it's been great.
Wow. So, and just now debuted at Brooklyn Kitchen. Why don't you tell people a little bit about what that is? Because that's a pretty unique place, I think, almost like a food cultural center in this food cultural borough of Brooklyn.
Right. Well, it is everything from a kitchen supply store, you know, where you can get everything from, you know, mixers to beer brewing supplies, winemaking supplies, books. In fact, you can, you know, buy the books for our book club there. They have an in-house butcher. It's the Meat Hook, which is really incredible. Cooking classes. Now they're doing more author events. So we're pretty lucky, I mean, to live in Brooklyn with all of this great, you know, literature and food happening right at our doorstep.
And tell me, so what do you think is the unique experience of sharing or discussing a book in that environment, and what do you have in store? What's your vision for the project, and what can people do who might not be in the vicinity of the Brooklyn Kitchen to do their own sort of thing?
Well, you know, it's very easy to sort of start a book club. I mean, these days I think everyone, you know, if they can make the time, is looking to sort of connect in a meaningful way. And a book club, you know, allows you to sort of feel like you're doing something, you're learning something. And, you know, we like to drink wine and have fun. Some really great friendships have come out of the book club. In fact, a business that's thriving right now came out of my initial book club. They're called Ovenly, and these basically one of the girls brought pistachio cardamom cupcakes to go with a book we were reading, which was called Curry, A Tale of Cooks and Conquerors, you know, history of India through the spice trade. And so she brought those, you know, in theme with the book, which we always do. One of the other women in the book club took a bite. They looked at each other, you know, having never really met before, and said, let's start a business. And, you know, they just opened a retail storefront in Greenpoint. So,
well, so careful what you bring to your next book club or your potluck, because you might end up with a career at
a
shop.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, in general, I'd say I like being a catalyst for people, you know, pursuing creative projects. Like I also host a series called Speakeasy, Conversations with Artists and Entrepreneurs. And, you know, one reason I think why the Brooklyn Kitchen came to me to ask me to facilitate their book club is because I did an event last year about Brooklyn food collaborations. You know, where there's a fisherman who spends half the year in Alaska who has a CSA where he sells fish at the Brooklyn Kitchen. So I talked to him and a fish distributor. And so anyway, it's like the Brooklyn Kitchen is this place where a lot converges. So It's very fertile ground.
And I was recently at a Brooklyn Book Fair. Were you involved in that? And how did that?
I wasn't. Oh.
Sorry, I should have known that. But, were you there? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Where they did bring a bunch of people to the Wyeth Hotel and who had something to do in some ways with Brooklyn, but mostly with books, really unusual magazines and stuff like that.
Right.
So
yeah.
One
of my favorite new journals is Remedy. Have you seen that quarterly? They were there. And yeah, I'd like to be involved in it next year. I found out about it a little late this year, but yeah, I mean, I think the fact that we can have like a dedicated food book fair that's very well attended is pretty incredible.
Yeah, people came from all over.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Do you cook?
I do, yeah. I used to cook more, honestly. Like the other day, I saw an ad for Seamless Web, which is, you know, online food delivery service. And I cringed at their tagline, which was, this is the site for foodies who don't cook. And I was like, oof. But, you know, I think that is a phenomenon. And sometimes, you know, lately, just given my busy life and schedule and everything, I haven't been cooking as much as I'd like to. So Tamar Adler's book, their tagline of foodies who don't cook made me cringe in slight recognition. So between that and reading Tamar Adler's book, An Everlasting Meal, I've been cooking more.
Okay, good.
Partly because, you know, I used to belong to a CSA and belong to the Park Slope Food Co-op and, you know, cooked, you know, 5 or 6 dinners a night. And then, you know, I'll spare the details, but it hasn't been happening lately.
Well, reading takes time.
Yeah.
Cooking takes time. There is only so much time, even here in Brooklyn, where sometimes it seems like there's more time if you just are getting a coffee and no one seems to mind how long it's taking. So perhaps.
What I love about her book is, you know, she really kind of emphasizes the value and like imperfection. Like if you char an eggplant, turn it into baba ganoush. And she, you know, I think liberates home cooks from like that TV standard of perfection where everything is chopped perfectly and glistening. And, you know, she admits like she makes mistakes. She teaches you how to rescue, you know, meals that have almost gone awry. And just reminds you that it's better to cook, not necessarily better, but there's a lot of value in cooking something at home, and you can sort of make it delicious by, you know, adding more salt than you think you should.
Can you imagine ever doing a cookbook as part of the book club, do you think?
Yeah, like there's one really beautiful cookbook called Campfire Cookery. Mm-hmm. You know, it came out last summer. Included in that are lots of beautiful exercises like stargazing and, you know, tarot card reading. And so I think especially for summer, maybe next summer we'll read that. It could be like a really fun kind of just prompts like creativity and ideas. But
sure. About 6 years ago at the James Beard Foundation, we started on one Wednesday a month, and it's grown a little bit, something called Beard on Books, which was also trying to find a way to include all of this other stuff about food being written, not just cookbooks, which we've historically celebrated. Beard was a great cookbook writer. But to me, it's been so interesting to watch the audience for Beard on Books change, because it originally was people, you know, I would say an older crowd, a little more maybe with some more time on their hands, mm-hmm. A more typical cookbook audience, perhaps. And then, but I think as groups like this, as Brooklyn explodes, as interest in food has really trickled down to different categories of people, different ages, it's just changed. You never know who's going to be there, what book is going to alight a group or an audience. It's really a fascinating mm-hmm. time.
Yeah, so what have they been talking about lately?
Well, I should remember. I don't know who the last one was. I need to take a break, and I'm going to think about that. I'm going to check the website, jamesbeer.org, and we'll be right back.
Market, we believe in healthy snacking, eating our veggies, and supporting local. Check out Brad's Raw Chips, a local producer that created irresistible chips after their namesake's successful weight loss with a raw lifestyle. Their chips are gluten-free, nutrient-packed, and so good that you'll think you're indulging. For more information, visit bradsrawchips.com.
We're back. Sorry for that pause. Little technology blackout going on. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. We are talking with Kara Canella, who is, among other things, an editor of Biographile.com and the moderator of the Brooklyn Kitchen Book Club. And we have a question from a listener whose email I can't read because the phone has gone black and I don't know how to turn it on. But I think the gist of the question was... food is one of these things where there are some experts, quote unquote, and people who spend a lot of time thinking about it. But of course, everyone thinks they're an expert when it comes to food because everybody eats. And this listener asks, a real trend now is people who like food automatically think they know about food. So everyone is a writer and everyone eats. How does one sort this out when choosing books or blogs or even tweets? Does the quality of the information about food impact your enjoyment of a book about food, for instance? It's an interesting question.
Yeah, so it's sort of like a curatorial question.
I think so. Well, because there is the world of people interested in food, and then there's everyone who eats.
Right.
And I think one of the things that even at the Beard Foundation we wrestle with is trying to make those one world and not two worlds, because everybody ought to be able to enjoy everything, whether or not they care to know about it or to research it, or food just ought to be good. Mm-hmm. Period. But when you're writing. Well, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think, everyone has their unique, interests. Everyone's drawn to different things. So basically, if you find, say, a curator of information about food who you jive with, just kind of stick with them and then they can, open your eyes. And, say, Biographile, for instance, is... among, a lot of sites these days considered to be like discovery sites. Like, we're not necessarily reviewing all of these books. We couldn't possibly, given our bandwidth, but we're kind of pointing you, hey, if you like this, Gabrielle Hamilton's Blood, Bones, and Butter, you might like these five books.
Right.
That I may or may not have, read every single word of them, but being immersed in this world, I can sort of point you in that direction.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of value in, being open to just, what's happening right around you, in terms of, food and writers who you encounter. And like Nora Ephron, for example, not known completely as a food writer, but
of course not.
Food was such a huge part of, her sort of autobiographical novel, Heartburn, which I'm guessing we'll read for the Brooklyn Kitchen Book Club soon. And So pretty much once you're looking at the world through this lens, you know, of food, you can sort of see everything in this, I think, really interesting way, like three times a day when you're eating a meal, or even more often if you're looking at it with sort of close attention. It, you know, brings more, I don't know, depth and value to
right.
it.
I mean, I've said this, I think, maybe before on the show, but part of my research, actually, my doctoral dissertation was on the effect of media and our taste. Basically, I believe that discourse has a really important place in formulating food culture and some idea of what's good and what's bad. And I mean, it's part of the reason, actually, I started a radio show that called Taste Matters, because I do believe taste matters. And I do believe that literature and media and all of the cultural environment we're in impacts that. And mm-hmm. and if you look at great food cultures around the world, there's always literature and food and stuff related to that. It isn't a separate thing. It isn't some people are interested in food. It's like we all are, and we all understand the references. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I've thought that is interesting here is we have such a diverse food culture, so many different food cultures, unlike France or unlike Japan, which have some sort of, over the years, developed some sort of similarity, that the references aren't always going to work necessarily among the audience of readers, or the way that if you mention a French cassoulet, let's say, everyone in France knows what a cassoulet is, but here not everyone does, only a few people do. So mm-hmm. some ways I feel like through literature and through these non-food things is a way to develop that culture, to work towards growing an American food culture just by the very nature of a reference to a dish or a thing being thrown in someplace you don't expect it.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, compared to a lot of these other cultures, you know, we're in our infancy in terms of creating a food culture. So maybe that's what this, you know, phase in our development is all about, like sort of articulating what, you know, food means to us. And that's why there's such a explosion right now in food literature.
Mm-hmm. I've gone so far as to want to create a policing organization, the way that the GLAAD organization, you know, negotiates how gays and lesbians and transgender people are represented in media. You know, they sit down in Hollywood, apparently. I mean, I don't know. I've just heard told and seen the awards to negotiate how the representations are and to make sure whatever that they think they meet some standard. I think we ought to have that for food. I think as long as we're going to put food in somewhere, this speaks to that question we had from the listener, that as long as we're going to put it there, it ought to be right, or it ought to be good, or at least it ought to lead us towards some better food as opposed to just celebrating the, you know, the Big Mac or something. Not that that isn't an important part of our culture, but
yeah.
But let's make it good.
Yeah. Yeah. What a good, clean, safe, right? Is that the tagline for slow food or
yeah.
something like that?
Because I think those things are important. Mm-hmm. One experience I have with the book club, we actually have someone who dropped by the studio today from Toronto, who's here on a bit of an eating and a restaurant food tour. Dan Gutter is a guest. He dropped by the studio and is shocked to be put on the radio. But since the connection between us is Bonnie Stern, who's been running a book club for several years originally out of her cooking school in Canada, with authors who aren't necessarily about food, but they've inserted food into the conversation, I thought I would just say, hey, Dan, welcome. Welcome to Brooklyn.
Thanks, Mitchell.
As someone from another culture, a different country, what are your thoughts about what's going on in New York these days vis-a-vis Toronto? And tell us a little bit what's happening in Toronto food-wise, restaurant-wise.
I think we, in Toronto anyway, we just continue to try to catch up to what's
catch
happening
up to
here
what?
In New York. To the multiculturalism and the quality of food in New York. I mean, I don't think we ever will, or at least it'll take 100 years, but what you can do with the population and the talent and the love for food and culture here. I think Toronto is a smaller version of that. And I think we do our own thing very well. But I think it's actually maybe a problem that we keep trying to think we need to catch up to New York, when really we should just do our own thing and it'll probably work out a little better.
Interesting. Okay, so just be yourself, Toronto.
Just be.
It's my hometown, and
Junior
so I'm,
Toronto.
Right, Junior Toronto. Well, there's always been. I mean, that's part of what I think. I think those aspirations are really important when it comes to food and literature and all that sort of thing. That culture is not one unique thing. It all adds up. One of the things the Beard Foundation's always been trying to do is to assert food as a bona fide cultural art, the way that, I mean, we want you to support the Beard Foundation the way you support the opera or the ballet or these other large cultural institutions that we think have long established credibility, but we think food is as important. And in a place here where food hasn't always been taken that important, we think that you need people to be putting you out there. And I know that there are lots of grumblings in Toronto and in cities around the around America and around Canada who are really trying to create their own culture. And I think it includes books and art and all the aesthetic joys of life. Not and and food is a part of that, and we need to include it.
Right.
Thoughts? No? Yes? Suddenly I'm on a soapbox. I didn't expect to be.
No. When coming on your show, I was thinking a lot about the word taste. And when I'm curious, you know, about a concept and I really want to immerse myself in it, I tend to look up the origin of the word, you know? So in fact, there's this awesome iPhone app I just got. It's the Oxford, like, etymology yes. dictionary. And so what I thought was cool about taste and, you know, what brought me to that idea of, you know, food as this grounding thing in this age when so much is not grounded, that basically, you know, the word is rooted in, you know, touching, trying, testing, experience, sort of like the way a child interacts with the world, right? And so that's sort of like direct visceral joy, I think, in cooking and, you know, daydreaming about food is right. What is very like satisfying about reading books about food these days.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And reading is also one of those joys, I think, that we sometimes take for granted in our 140 character lives. Mm-hmm. Those of us who spend a lot of time on Twitter.
Mitchell, we have one more question that just came in.
Okay.
So this one's from Christine and Kara. She says, hi, you talked about the trendiness right now of being a foodie and the trendiness of food-oriented literature. I'm wondering, is this phenomenon simply a trend or is it a consciousness paradigm shift in the way we eat and think about food? If it is just a trend, what will we be left with after the trendiness passes? Are we as a culture permanently changed?
Another great question. This is a bonus day.
That is.
Yeah. And we have 3.5 minutes to answer it.
All right. I tend to think that maybe it's just because, you know, food and literature mean so much to me personally that this is not a trend. I just think it's something, you know, like I said, sort of in the evolution of our growing as like a food culture.
It's a stage, not a trend. Yeah.
Right. So maybe we're just like hyper aware right now as it's sort of the way a teenager is like hyper self-conscious mm-hmm. and trying to define, you know, him or herself. So maybe that's where we are right now with food and literature. So I don't think it's a trend, you know, just as like a teenager grows into an adult, you know,
right.
we'll
it's a phase.
Yeah. So it's what I think we're left with is just like mindfulness, basically, right. when it comes to food. And in fact, the book that really made me want to start my original food book club was Jane Goodall's Harvest for Hope, A Guide to Mindful Eating, which is, you know, this incredible, both a philosophical and practical guide to eating well. And she talks a lot about, you know, countries around the world, farming in Africa and so on. And so eventually we read that as for the book club, and it literally changed people's lives. Like one of my best friends who happened to be in the book club, she, you know, went from being a corporate, you know, litigation attorney to then working for Earth Justice. She became an environmental lawyer, you know, as she cites reading that book as the impetus Wow. for that change. You know, other people, you know, joined CSAs and so on after reading that book.
Interesting. Well, and certainly when you look at, in France, I've spent a lot of time looking historically at France, where food culture is said to have originated, as we know it, sort of in the 18th century, right around the time of the French Revolution. And it was as crazy from what it looks like now. It was as crazy then as it feels now. It seemed as trendy. People were writing about things. There was no blog, but there was the Almanach des Gourmands, where it could have been a blog when you read the little posts that Grimaud de la Reynière wrote and all that sort of stuff. And apparently you couldn't go into a restaurant and not hear people talking about their next meal. And it just, you read sort of historical accounts of that time. And like you said, I just think it's very much a part of the phase of development of forming a food culture, and we've come so far so fast. Mm-hmm. One of the things in reading all the obituaries about Nora Ephron today that struck me was the piece that she wrote, I think it's almost 30, maybe even 40 years ago, about the food culture in New York then, and how she was so prescient. She almost described my life today about how there were these grand chefs and these masters and people running around from this place to that place. I mean, there wasn't the food truck and there wasn't the blog and there wasn't Twitter then, but she definitely previsioned this moment that we're in. And it's even something you see at Toronto, since Dan is here, this foment in a good way this bubbling, this gurgling of interest, I think, as you said, is just a phase to the next thing. Mm-hmm. And reading and literature are as important about that as anything. You had a great quote from Efron, I think, that might be a nice way to end the show.
Right. And I think, you know, in this age of Twitter and sort of difficulty sometimes focusing on long form reading, it's important to remember, you know, reading's not something that we should do. It's something that can come out of like desire and joy. So this quote from her, which, you know, I posted this morning on Biographile, reminded me of that. She says in her second to last essay collection, "I feel bad about my neck and other thoughts on being a woman." She says, "Reading is everything. Reading makes me feel like I've accomplished something, learned something, become a better person. Reading makes me smarter. Reading gives me something to talk about later on. Reading is an unbelievably healthy way my attention deficit disorder medicates itself. Reading is escape and the opposite of escape. It's a way to make contact with reality after a day of making things up. And it's a way of making contact with someone else's imagination after a day that's all too real. Reading is grist. Reading is bliss."
Very nice. I would just change eating every time there's reading there. And
exactly.
That would work too.
She probably would and couldn't.
Yeah, for a different essay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you. We will miss you, Nora Ephron, certainly. Thank you, Kara, for being here. Thank you, Dan, for being the surprise guest on the show. Next week, we are not here. It's July 4th, and someone will be barbecuing somewhere, some wonderfully American things. But the week after that, we're going to welcome the nutritionist and the chef from a great restaurant in New York called Rouge Tomate, which has a very unique sustainable and nutrition mission and also produces some of the most incredible food, I think, in the city. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, eat something delicious.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.